Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. What would our practice be like if we weren't losing our so-called independence? I suppose this is how it is when someone is in prison and they take up meditation practice. But in fact, we live in a mental prison. Even though we're free to go here, there, so to speak, we're free, but we're not free. We're not free of the five hindrances. And so the mind is constantly imprisoned in walls, in obstacles, in barriers of its own making. An untrained mind is constantly churning and burning with desire, directionless, like a boat without a compass, no navigator, no instrument to keep it on course. And then we receive a teaching, a map, a spiritual map to guide us back home, to guide us out of the darkness into a mental abiding that enables us to dwell truly, peacefully, and free. Moment by moment, we learn this. And the tools we're starting to get familiar with, this is why it's called practice. Just like if you want to sail a boat, you have to learn how to use a rudder. If it's a sailboat, you have to learn how to raise the sail and secure it to the mast, and how to orient the boat in currents, in winds. And so it is with our little raft to Nibbana, this body-mind. We sit, we seclude ourselves, and we study how it works so that we can properly train ourselves. And once we learn how to fine-tune this instrument of the mind, fine-tuned, properly tuned to emptiness, to its own original nature, without all the dross that we pile into it, it becomes a miraculous gift to us. Today we had the good fortune to go for a walk in the old growth forest. This walk that we took is a bit like the voyage of the spiritual seeker. We had to have a guide take us there, a guide with a bell that helped us to stop from time to time and just feel what it was like to be guided there, right into the forest. And as we enter into the forest, we see these very, very old trees, magnificent trees. They're so tall and so wide, so large, so majestic, that they take our breath away. But we're trying to walk very mindfully and pay attention. Going into the forest like that is a bit like what we do when we come from the business and the activity, a lot of movement, a lot of preoccupation in our worldly lives. We come to this center and we sit down and try to practice mindfulness of the breath or mindfulness of the body. So mindfulness is the act of recollecting, remembering, where is the breath? Where is it? And finding the way to the breath We use mindfulness. And returning again and again to the breath, this is part of what mindfulness helps us to do. Sati. Now, if you had to go to the old growth forest, it wouldn't be hard. We know the way. We know the path. We've been there. But we don't yet really know much about the old growth forest. Every one of us would probably give a different description of what it is. One of us might have been focusing on the poison ivy. There was some right in the middle of the path, even. So it's not just innocent meander through a majestic forest. We have to be very aware and on guard for the dangers on the path. There's probably a bit of poison oak. There may be other kind of stinging, biting creatures. And by spending more time in the forest, we would get to know these things. We would easily identify them. And then we would be able to go there on our own. We would become more comfortable. This is what happens when we study and investigate the object with mindfulness. That's knowing the object and how to come back to it, how to stay close to it. And sampajanya, this activity of getting to clearly know what it is we're studying. What is it? If we're just doing a very quick survey, just a quick little visit, we don't get to spend enough time there to develop a clear understanding of all that composes, all that makes up that beautiful old growth forest. But if we were to stay there for the whole day, or if we were to spend the retreat there, we would get to see different kinds of wonderful birds, frogs, maybe turtles, rabbits. Maybe we would see deer and other creatures. There's a story that Ajahn Chah tells of when he was on Tudong in the jungles of Thailand, when he would stop to set up his abiding for the evening. It wasn't until he would stay absolutely still in one spot that these strange creatures would start to appear. Usually he would pick somewhere near a river or a creek, some water source, and very early in the morning, just before the sun would come up, as the night would be receding, these very mysterious and wonderful creatures would come to take a drink. But they didn't come unless he was stiller than still, deeply in meditation, so that they had no inkling of any human presence. In the same way, when we use sati, knowing the object, staying with the object, sampajanya, clearly understanding it, studying it, and also ardency, this sense of an incredible eagerness. It's like an earnestness, a curiosity, a dedication to studying this object, and to clearing away all the hindrances that might be preventing us from observing, from knowing, from tasting the real details of that object. Not just keeping away the hindrances and stopping the mind from wandering into thoughts, but being absolutely still, being totally with the present moment. We too would begin to see marvelous things in the mind's own brightness, in the mind's own stillness, in the quiet of the present moment. And this is where panya, wisdom, comes to our rescue. We're in the forest. We're observing. But we know where the poison ivy is, so we don't go there. We don't stop. We don't sit down on a patch of anthills. But we take a secluded, secure spot, and we use these factors of mindfulness with its different components, sati, sampajanya, the clear knowing, this atapi, this ardent, earnest wish to focus, to penetrate through to the reality of the object in the present moment so that we understand its true nature. Then panya is revealed. Panya arises. And this comes through the very, very deep, sustained practice of samadhi of the mind. Dispelling hindrances as soon as they arise. When we walked in the old growth forest, when mosquitoes were swarming around us, it was enough just to wave the hand a little bit or to walk at a quick pace and they would give up. Especially when we came back into the sun. And so it is with our meditation practice. We have to be so committed to the stillness, stilling the mind. Then the mosquitoes, all the toxins, they don't have a chance to bite us, hurt us, distract us from enjoying the beautiful forest. So the hindrances don't have a chance to land, to take away our energy, our effort, our focus. They leave us alone. And when they leave us alone completely, then we enter into that real, penetrating concentration that is more rock-like, that is more steady and constant, that is untiring, unwavering, like a mountain, like a tree, very tall. Those giant pines, maybe 200 or 300 feet tall. But they're impermanent. Just like the jhanas, they're also impermanent. As unwavering and strong and stable as they may be, they are yet of the mundane sphere. They're impermanent. So the happiness and joy and peace that we get from jhana does not last. We can experience it when we learn how to really steady the mind and use these tools of dispelling the poisons and toxins or the hindrances to fully be present for an hour without moving, or even longer, as we determine, as we resolve. But unless we develop wisdom, that peace and happiness is insubstantial, impermanent, does not last. So it's very useful for us to reflect on where the path will take us and what we really want from this journey, what we're really striving for, is the freedom, the real liberation from these hindrances that is irreversible. Even if we go back into the world, if we develop a panya, a wisdom that is liberating, has a quality to free us once and for all from the poisons, the distractions, the taints of the mind, then we will really taste a true and lasting freedom. And the joy of that freedom we can always return to and taste. Once we know the path, once we know the tools, once we understand what the dangers are, and there are dangers on the path, knowing how to identify them. When you see, for example, that your mind is dull, we learn how to use energy to penetrate through the dullness. When we feel tired, we learn how to aim our focus and sharpen it. Just like when you're focusing the lens of a camera. If it's dull or blurry, we just turn it slightly and keep turning until we sharpen our focus. It's important to be able to see clearly. We're looking for clarity. Supposing there was a terrible storm and it would rain, heavy rain, it would be more difficult to reach the forest, to find the trail. The wind would be howling. We wouldn't even want to go there. So when we're out in the world and the storms of life are howling around us, overwhelming us, what do we do? Well, we've learned some of the tricks, some of the tools. We're learning them slowly. And it takes time. Here we have very, very perfect conditions. Nobody coming to interrupt our meditation. We just have to sit and be present to our own inner turmoil. And once we identify that we ourselves are creating it, it's a great relief because we take responsibility. We can no longer blame any other conditions, worldly conditions. There's no one, no thing, no event in our lives that we can blame for that. That neither the sadness, nor can we expect any of the conditions of the world to give us the happiness that we're looking for. Any experience that we take refuge in, like some people love going to concerts, or going out with friends, or going for a holiday to an exotic country, exotic land. I remember a friend coming to ask me if I knew any good places to go and visit. And I thought, where is there to go? And I said, you're old, where are you going? Where are you going to go? And he said, well, I thought I might go visit Peru. I heard that there's some good ruins there. But we're old. We are already good ruins, declining. Where is there to go? What's there to look for in the world? We are inside of ourselves already, wrecks. We've been through it all. Even if you're not old, but you're in your 30s, 40s, old enough to know the way to the old growth forest, old enough to know that there is something beyond this conditioned world, something rich, lovely, a gift, a joy, beyond the worldly things. The world can never keep its promises. It promises us so much. Look at what the media generate. They show you all these pictures of where you could go or what you could own. And then you go out and buy it and they develop a new one to make the new object that you just bought obsolete before it's even been used very much. How do we keep up with this? It's a useless pursuit because these possessions and instruments and objects of the world, experiences, the vacations, all the rest of it, none of it brings us satisfaction. As soon as we've gone on it, we're already planning the next one. I remember going to teach a retreat not long ago, and I noticed that on the table, they had the advertisement for the next retreat, the next event people could look forward to and sign up for. This is a very worldly thing to do. How can we practice being present? If we were walking through the old growth forest and I were to start passing out brochures about Algonquin Park, why don't we go camping and canoeing in Algonquin Park? How would we be able to enjoy the beauties of this forest that's right here? But this is what the mind makes us do all the time. We have the present moment. It's right under our noses. We just have to be with it. Open it. Open ourselves to it. Dive into it. Study it. Taste it. Excluding everything else. Just know that so deeply. Then we wouldn't be wishing for other moments. If only I could breathe differently, have a different breath. I know this sounds ridiculous, but this is what the mind will say. If only the present moment had other ingredients in it, the mind would find fault. It wouldn't be perfect. But the world will never be perfect. Worldly things will never be perfect. The shrine room, the body, the timetable, the food, it'll never be perfect. We want to squeeze perfection out of things that are imperfect by nature. Why are they imperfect? Because they are impermanent, insubstantial, empty. They just bring suffering. Can't bring us happiness. They can bring us a little satisfaction, temporary, very shallow, superficial. But we're not looking for material and superficial happiness. We're looking for that perfect, indestructible, sublime, transcendent reality, which is beyond this conditioned world. And the way to find it is in the most simple present moment, stopping the mind to know, to turn towards itself and to know itself fully and to find that perfection right there, nowhere else. When I first spent time in the monastery in Burma, and I was doing walking meditation in my room, in my cell, very simple, very plain wooden platform to sleep on and to meditate on. Occasional geckos would come and visit. We don't have those in Canada. They're very amazing creatures. I had a salt tree flowering outside my window. And I felt that I was in a deva realm, heaven realm, just walking up and down in this tiny little room. Seven steps from the wall to the door, turn around. Seven steps from the door to the wall. Sometimes I would walk out in the pavilion. There were scorpions, which is good. Then one had to be very mindful not to step on one. And they didn't tell you when they were going to cross the path. And I felt, I never want to leave. What else is there to do in this world but go to the center of my being and understand fully what that is? It seemed treasure enough. I was 37. I recommend this highly. The Buddha's tools are guaranteed. If we use them properly and we seek those treasures, we will find them right here in our own hearts. We don't have to spend thousands of dollars to travel to exotic places looking for ruins, buildings that have fallen to the ground. or beautiful artifacts that were created by civilizations long lost, long gone. We don't have to use so much energy to cross the world, cross the ocean. I did it all. It didn't bring me that deep inner peace of just being with myself in seclusion, going into the depths of my own heart with like-minded friends living in a monastery. And yet the world does not promote this. When we develop panya, spiritual wisdom, we don't have to give up the world. The world gives us up. It's a natural process. And when we develop panya, we don't have a desire to play with worldly things anymore. We just want the real treasures. So I encourage you to contemplate these things and examine not only how the meditation practice is, but how is your life? And what are we doing with our lives? What is the direction of our life's journey? Are we living skillfully? Do we feel good about ourselves? If we don't feel good about ourselves, what kind of a mental prison are we living in? How can we free ourselves from that? It's so simple. All we have to do is practice mindfulness and clear comprehension of the present moment, using wisdom to examine what it is we're clinging to, and using renunciation to let it go. Resolving to let it go and letting it go. Coming back to the present moment. To use the mind skillfully so that we're not distracted into things that bring misery, disappointment, and death to our joy, death to our peace, death to our inner tranquility. Instead, we should be working and living in a way that we bring death to anger and ill will, death to ignorance and greed, death to confusion and sense desire and distraction. These are the things that we need to slowly put to rest for good. And we can do that. Little by little, gradually, step by step. We begin with one breath, and we just work breath by breath, moment by moment. Hearing sound of silence, day by day. Joy will grow and develop until we are as tall as those majestic trees in the old growth forest. And we are clear, upright, straight and steadfast on the path. And we know the way.